Hi, dear listeners. Here I am with Monica Strömdahl at Vision du Real. And Monica directed just at a movie that premiered at Copenhagen Dogs, and now it's at the next important festival, Flophouse America. This documentary, it looks inside the flop houses of America, the cheap hotels where many poor families stay. It's kind of the last step before you get homeless. How did you even get into that world of flop houses? Because usually it's a very secluded world. One would not just randomly check in there.
Hi, and Lida, thank you so much for inviting me to talk with you. It's a big honor. It's actually a story that dates back to 2005. I was living for a short period of time myself in the cheapest hotel I could find in New York. And checking in there introduced me to a community of people that were excluded from the traditional housing market and lived in the hotel permanently due to the fact that they couldn't get anything better in their income brackets in the city. I stayed there months at a time for a few years, and I photographed the people there because, you know, they became my friends slowly. This hotel shut down due to gentrification in 2013. And that process was so slow and painful for everyone involved. Going through that with them made me just think that the system is somewhat injustice for the people. I decided to document this way of living across the US to be basically a voice for those who couldn't speak up themselves. And I did journeys, a few journeys every year, and it was on one of these journeys that I met Michael. My method is always the same. I check in and I stay for weeks at a time until people want to, you know, talk with me, share their story, and then I photograph and then I move on. But when I met Michael, you know, he's the first child, and I met many children in many states in the US who also live in hotels or motels. But he was the first one that was born into this situation. And also born in the crossfire of poverty and addiction. Seeing him raise some new awareness of and new questions about how it is to be a child to grow up in instability. Yet he had such a strong mind. He was and is school smart, street smart, and he had a unique way of navigating his reality and his parents. He was on a search, definitely, for a better life for himself. And his parents, you know, they did everything they could for him to have a better upbringing than they had themselves. So what I saw was generational trauma, a generational cycle in poverty at play. You know, I was impressed with Michael and his inner strength. He was, like I said, on a search for a better life, and I wanted to join him on that search. I found that photography wouldn't be enough to tell his story. I wanted to give this family more space to talk, space to move, and to show the complexities of their person and life beyond still photography. The 15-year still photography project turned into a film with Michael and his family. But yeah, meeting them was a very long, an organic process that, without planning, had become my life project, so to say.
You mentioned first that you checked in one of the cheapest hotels you can find. Why actually were you broke? Was it to realize the photo project? What was the motivation to check in there?
So I was a student at the time. I wanted to be, as a photographer, I wanted to be close to the arts. I wanted to learn about photography. Mm-hmm. Like really learn without holding the hand of my professor at the university. I knew that I needed to be independent if I was going to make it as a photographer. I wanted to live and breathe the art of the photography. And to me, being in New York was at the center. That's where I was drawn to. That's where I could be close to the artists and life of photography. And I would just be there to learn to be an independent photographer at heart. In order to be able to do that, you know, it's a very expensive city. I did actually ask around for the cheapest place I could possibly stay to be able to be there for months at a time. And it was a coincidence, you know, that I checked in there, but maybe not a coincidence after all, because it really has been a long and important road for me to take as a human and also as a photographer.
Then another thing you mentioned, you said that these people cannot tell their own story. Why do you think that underclass people can't tell our own story?
I do think that everyone could be capable of telling their own story, but I do think that we need also to stand together to tell the stories that tells us something about who we are as humans and how the society is built together, and to be mirrors of the cracks in our society, to shed a light on what is actually not working. This is the only way I believe that we can actually do something about the problems that we have as a community, is by shedding the light of what is not working. My calling, actually, I am a storyteller, but I'm also deeply concerned about the cracks that we have, the safety nets that doesn't work. But I do believe that we have to stand together about, you know, important issues of our society. And sometimes that's the reality we live in ourselves. Sometimes it's someone else's reality. But I believe that, you know, by spending time doing the proper research, connecting with the people that you would like to tell the story of, I think it's possible for anyone to tell anyone's story. We can all be tools in order to try to fight for and make a better community for all of us.
Your film very much focuses on two things in this family's lives. One is psychological violence, and another one is what you call addiction, what I personally call it, substance use. And the first thing is, could it not be that what some people might perceive as substance abuse or addiction in this film is more like a way of life, since substance use is deeply ingrained in our society? All classes, not only the underclass, use substances, but only the underclass gets stigmatized for substance use. If somebody from middle or upper class drinks two glasses of expensive scotch in the evening, he's a connoisseur. If somebody from the underclass drinks two beers every evening, he's a habitual alcoholic. So would you say that this is not maybe a view, something that people project on the underclass, and something that also that it's justified just to take medication and substances? Because many people take permanent medication due to psychological illnesses, due to physical illnesses. So
absolutely, the stigma is real, for particularly for people who are in the lower classes. But this film is a film... this is Michael's point of view. Like, if I had made a film seen with the perspective of Michael's parents, it would have been looked completely different, because for them, the drinking and the, you know, the substance use is not the problem for them. But for Michael, it is a problem. And I discovered that because, you know, through the arguments that were between them. When I started this project, my entry to the project was the housing crisis. But when, as I discovered when filming and getting to know the family, when Michael screams to his father, he doesn't scream for a bigger room or more money. He screams for them to change their way and to stop the drinking. So that was Michael's problem in the situation he was, and that's why it is a problem in this film as well. You might say that the drinking itself, they're not doing anything illegal. It's legal to drink and it's legal to smoke. But the long-term effects that it had on Michael's mind, because he was unable to connect with his parents in the way that he wanted to, that was concerning.
You also decided to film the people always inside the hotel. Yeah. So we never see them doing anything outside. And most of the action takes place in one small room the family is crouched in together. Mm-hmm. How did you make that decision? And do they actually spend so much time inside? We learn that at least the father goes to work.
Yeah.
And Michael goes to school.
Absolutely. Michael goes to school every day. And Michael's father goes to work every day. The reason why I chose to stay inside the room, that was to portray the claustrophobic feeling of the situation that Michael was stuck in, to show the mental claustrophobia and that he was stuck. Like, it's hard to breathe. He had no power in this room. He has no power over his parents. And by being in there, where was the only room that they were together, this is where they met. And I wanted to focus on the family dynamics. And this is where the family dynamics was happening. And I made sure to include, they talk about the school. School is a big issue. So they talk about the school a lot. That's their one of their main focuses in their everyday, is how Michael is doing in school. I actually, even though they talk about the school a lot, because I'm not showing him at school, I thought that it might be difficult to, or some might think that actually, you know, he is trapped there. So I also have, you know, included, we see Michael at some point, you know, he goes out, also spends time in the lobby working, you know, he goes out to buy ice cream. So because I was scared that people would think that he was actually trapped, but he's not. He's very much free and to come and go as he wishes. The door there is never locked, but it was inside the bedroom that his home reality was happening, and the dynamics and the conversations between them. And that is a driving factor in the film. But it was very much to focus on the mental entrapment, the feeling of not being able to break out. That's why I decided to stay inside with the family.
How do you think that your presence influenced the things that happened in the room?
I absolutely think that my presence affected what happening in the room on a theoretical level. Of course, I think our presence as filmmakers affects any room that we are in when we are there with the camera. You know, I spent a lot of time with the family to get to know each other, for them to get to know me. I want them to live their lives as they would, as if I was not there. But I do think that they felt seen by me being there. I know that Michael felt seen. I also think that he felt empowered. And maybe I know that they felt safe with me because we had worked a long time on building that trust. They knew that they had the power in the room. They, whenever they stopped filming, we did it. And on days, you know, when Michael didn't want to wear a mic, we didn't film. And so that they knew that they had the power of me being in the room always. So that was very important for me. But I think that they've actually felt stronger, perhaps. And maybe Michael was able to speak up his mind more. Like, you know, they wanted their story to be told. So they thought it was important that I was there. And I think that me being there made them feel important and seen as well.
There's also one particular tragedy that happens during the film. That is, it happens in the last third. One of the characters actually dies. Were you present when that happened?
I was not present when that happened. This was in 2020, so it was in the middle of COVID. And I am based in Norway. Whenever in between shoots and in between times I would be there, when I was at home, we would have continuous conversations, and we would talk about other things than the film as well. They would know, keep me updated on everyday topics, you know, school and work and gaming. So we had like a natural communication outside the shooting of the film as well. And so I was one of the first people that Michael called when his mom passed. And if it hadn't been for COVID and closed borders, I would have been on the next flight to the US to be with the family first and foremost, to make sure that they were taken care of, you know, with food and with help in this extreme situation. But I wasn't able to do that. And actually, there has been, through the process of making this film, there was many times where I thought that this wouldn't be a film. When Tanya passed, that was one of the times where I was sure that the project would stop. I thought, you know, this will not be a film. That's okay. We were all in shock. And I was just there for them as a friend. But months went by, and Michael and Jason the son and the father, they invited me to be a part of the funeral, so to say, because they thought that it was an important last chapter to the film. And that for me was a profound moment of trust, that I took it as a clear message that they wanted me to continue the project. They actually waited for me to be able to travel to the US. So the first flight I was able to take 10 months after the incident, I did. I went there, but what wasn't planned was actually what they didn't wait for me for was the fact that they were moving. Also, they were changing their home location, and that happened by coincidence. On the just 4 hours after I landed, they started packing.
Were there any things that you took out because you thought it was inappropriate to show them?
This film took a long time to make, and most of it is out. What is in is what I feel is necessary in order to tell the story. So there is, and of course I have watched the footage together with the family so they could give their feedback on what they thought was okay to have in the film. That was so important to me to have in the edit, to have a clear and steady balance between being true to the facts and what happens from Michael's perspective. But also I wanted to make a film that they could live with, because they are going to, you know, carry this film. It's going to be with them forever. You know, there was ethical balance that was in place, that needed to be in place there. There are private moments that I filmed that are not necessary to have in the film to tell the story.
Since you have now worked more than a decade on this project, do you have already a next project or something that you're thinking about?
So right now, we are entering a new era for the film. We're on this festival round. I'm very much 100% in this project still. We're building a strong impact campaign. We want to use the film to spark discussion and do good for other people who are in a situation like Michael and his family. And that is a slow process that takes a lot of time, but it's important for us to do it because that was the family's motivation for being part of this project, is to show the world how it feels in order to spark the conversation and try to make change. You know, this family, people who grow up like Michael, they need a strong support system to overcome the social stigma and the other obstacles that they face because of the reality that they are brought up in. So we're going to use this film to try to look at what is not working in our society. And the film is in America and in this small bedroom. But the fact is that Michael's story is not unique. Children fall through the cracks of society in all countries. We need to cherish the support and safety nets that we do have. We need to make them stronger by developing them and not taking them for granted. I hope that by showing what it feels like to be Michael, we can use the film to contribute to conversations about how to make support systems stronger. So that is a work that takes time, and I'm very much focused on it, but that's where I am right now.
Thank you so much for this interview, Monika Strömdahl. Flophouse America is still at Vision du Reel. If it gets an release somewhere, you of course read it with us. I thank you very much. I'm still Ida Bach. Keep on listening in.